Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Brian Lynn, and Steve Ember. But first, this report. This year, many students who are graduating from universities across the United States and in many countries will not get to enjoy traditional celebrations of their success. A growing number of schools are canceling or postponing their graduation ceremonies because of the worldwide spread of the coronavirus. But in the U.S., the cancellations do come at a time when the national graduation rate is continuing to increase. Mikyung Ryu is the director of research publications for the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. She told VOA that for a long time, the national rate of completion for 2- and 4-year college study programs stayed a little over 50%. The U.S. Department of Education reports the nation's graduation rate. But Ryu said it has not been getting the full picture of who actually was entering higher education. She noted that the agency was not including in its numbers students who left college to study at different schools. Also, many older students and ones working full-time jobs have started attending colleges and universities in recent years. These people are often unable to complete their programs in the usual 2 or 4 years. The traditional measure of college completion outcomes does not work well anymore. So it has to be adjusted to better address the increasingly complex student profile, said Ryu. So in 2009, the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center asked over 3,600 colleges and universities in 45 states for more complete student data. For students in 2-year programs, the group looked at how many students graduated within 3 years. For 4-year programs, it looked at the 6-year graduation rate. The center also included information on students who moved from one school to another to continue their education. Last December, the center released a comparison between the 6-year graduation rate for all students who started in the fall of 2009 to those who started in the fall of 2013. Researchers found the overall graduation rate had increased to 60%. Ryu said the results represent a nationwide success story because gains were found in 43 out of 45 states. Yet experts like Iris Palmer say the national graduation rate does not tell the whole story. She is a top advisor for higher education and the workforce at New America, a public policy research group. She noted that because of the rising cost of higher education in the U.S., many schools are under pressure to show their success in both completion and job placement. In addition, some colleges and universities might admit only the highest performing candidates in order to increase their completion rates. If you become more selective, you're more likely to have a higher graduation rate, Palmer said. So the worry is that if you focus too much on the graduation rate, you disadvantage low-income and historically discriminated against populations, because it is actually harder to get them to graduate. Still, Palmer notes schools and policymakers have made an effort to improve student success. This includes measures to improve guidance for students through their programs, as well as other support services. Josh Weiner agrees that overall, this seems to be a sign that American higher education is moving in the right direction. He is the executive director of the College Excellence Program at the Aspen Institute. But he notes 60% is still low, and it is not clear what this number means for the future. There is still more to be done that can increase the rate, Weiner argued. This includes exploring new teaching methods and increasing efforts to make all students, especially non-traditional ones, feel like they belong at colleges and universities. It also means including different kinds of study programs in this count. The credentials that matter are the ones that enable somebody to get a good job, regardless of whether that's technical training or traditional liberal arts, Weiner said. I'm Pete Musto.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. The spread of dangerous diseases around the world is not new. As trade and colonization expanded worldwide over hundreds of years, so did some dangerous diseases. And smallpox was one of the worst of them. Happily, smallpox has been eradicated, meaning it does not exist in nature anymore. The story of how smallpox was defeated is closely linked to the English word vaccine. However, before modern science made that happen, humans had suffered from the disease for a very long time. Researchers even found a 3,000-year-old Egyptian mummy with smallpox scars. Smallpox was a severe and deadly disease. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention describes smallpox as devastating. On average, 3 out of every 10 people who got it died. Those who survived were usually left with scars, which were sometimes severe. By the 18th century, smallpox was still infecting and killing people around the world. But in England, there were some interesting stories going around about milkmaids. Milkmaids were women who milked cows. They were known to get a mild disease called cowpox. And the scientific term for cowpox is at the heart of our story about the English word vaccine. Cowpox is a disease that affects cows but can spread to humans through a scratch or cut. Cowpox would often cause a few sores, but it is not serious. Smallpox, however, can leave terrible scars at the very least and cause death at the very worst. But milkmaids did not seem to get the damaging disease. A British doctor named Edward Jenner wanted to find out if the stories were true. So he did an experiment on his gardener's son, 9-year-old James Phipps. Jenner took material from a milkmaid's cowpox sore and injected it into the child. The 9-year-old predictably got cowpox. But months later, when Jenner exposed Phipps to smallpox, the child never became infected. Jenner performed this experiment on more people before publishing his findings, calling them an inquiry into the causes and effects of variolae vaccinae. The Latin term variolae vaccinae means something like pustules from a cow. A pustule is a small bump on the skin that contains or produces infected fluid, or pus. And let's face it, pustule, whether in Latin or not, is a bit gross. So it is the word vaccine, based on the Latin word for cow, vacca, that stuck. In time, vaccines became known as the substances that give immunity from other diseases as well. And that is the story of the English word vaccine, which brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
In Singapore, a group of workers has been given an important job in the fight against the new coronavirus. The workers are called contact trackers. Their job is to interview infected individuals as soon as possible after the patients are confirmed to have COVID-19, the disease the virus causes. The contact trackers speak with hospitalized patients over telephone. They are separated from infected individuals by two glass walls. The information they collect is then used to find out as much as possible about the patient's movements and contacts during the 2 weeks before they were hospitalized. Conceso Edwin Philip is one of the contact trackers. For several weeks, he has kept himself ready to get to the hospital as quickly as possible to interview new patients. "We have to drop everything, scramble, and figure out where these patients have been," said Philip, an employee of Singapore General Hospital. Philip is not a medical professional, but his work has become very important in the city-state's efforts to fight the virus. Singapore has won international praise for taking strong and immediate measures to battle COVID-19, which first appeared in China. Early on, Singapore had one of the highest infection rates outside of China. But other nations have since reported much higher spreads. One example of how seriously Singapore is taking the virus fight came last month. Officials charged a Chinese couple with giving false information to workers seeking to track the couple's movements and contacts. Philip said one way he tries to get patients to remember details about their movements is to ask them about all their meals on each day. Because once they can remember who they sat down with for a meal, that would give a rough estimate of the number of people in their surroundings, Philip said. And they can usually remember what they did. Philip has experience tracking patient contacts for other diseases. He says it can be very difficult to get people to remember small details. But he added that it helps to stay cheerful. "You have to be very, very patient with them," he added. "Don't get angry, because just like you and me, most of us can't remember a lot of things." Philip usually has about 2 hours to interview patients about their whereabouts, travel history, and contacts. He also examines their work calendars, computer records, and purchase history. Philip also uses hospital records to identify which health workers have come into contact with COVID-19 patients. Philip gives his results to a health ministry team that then speaks with identified individuals. Sometimes police also use video from security cameras to find those at risk. Those people are then put into quarantine and closely watched for signs of the virus. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We look at the presidential election campaign of 1952. President Harry Truman decided not to seek re-election. The continuing war in Korea and economic problems at home had cost him the support of many Americans. His Democratic Party needed a new candidate for president. In the spring of 1952, Harry Truman offered his support to Adlai Stevenson. Stevenson, however, said he was not interested in any job except the one he had as governor of Illinois. Someone asked what he would do if the Democratic Party chose him anyway as its presidential candidate. Stevenson jokingly answered that he would have to shoot himself. So President Truman and other party leaders discussed different candidates. Each one, however, seemed to have some political weakness. The Republican Party was also discussing possible candidates. It was much easier for the Republicans to choose. Earlier, General Dwight Eisenhower had said he would be interested in running for president. Eisenhower was the highly respected commander of Allied forces in Europe during World War II. Many members of both parties supported Ike, as he was popularly known. Eisenhower agreed to campaign as a Republican. His closest competitor for the Republican nomination was Robert Taft. Taft was a senator from Ohio and the son of a former president, William Howard Taft. Senator Taft had strong support among Republicans for his conservative positions. But he did not receive enough votes at the party's national convention to defeat Eisenhower for the nomination. In his acceptance speech, Eisenhower told the delegates,
"Ladies and gentlemen, you have summoned me on behalf of millions of your fellow Americans to lead a great crusade for freedom in America and freedom in the world. I know something of the solemn responsibility of leading a crusade. I take up this task, therefore, in a spirit of deep obligation, mindful of its burdens and of its decisive importance. I accept your summons. I will lead this crusade."
Eisenhower chose Senator Richard Nixon of California as his running mate for vice president. Nixon was known for strongly opposing communism.
"I am holding in my hand a microfilm of very highly confidential secret State Department documents. These documents were fed out of the State Department over 10 years ago by communists who were employees of that department and who were interested in seeing if these documents were sent to the Soviet Union, where the interests of the Soviet Union happened to be in conflict with those of the United States."
Earlier, as a member of the House of Representatives, Richard Nixon had led the investigation of a former State Department official, Alger Hiss. Hiss was accused of helping to provide secret information to the Soviet Union. He denied the accusation and was never charged with spying. but he was tried and found guilty of lying to a grand jury and was sentenced to prison. Democrats opened their presidential nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois, 10 days after the Republicans closed theirs in the same city. Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson welcomed the delegates, but still seemed like he did not want to run for president. That only made the delegates want him even more. They were unable to choose a nominee on the first two votes. Then, on the third vote, a majority of the delegates chose Adlai Stevenson, and he accepted. He urged Democrats to campaign with honor.
Let's talk sense to the American people. Let's tell them the truth, that there are no gains without pains, that we are now on the eve of great decisions, not easy decisions, like resistance when you're attacked, but a long, patient, costly struggle which alone can assure triumph over the great enemies of man, war, poverty, and tyranny, and the assaults upon human dignity, which are the most grievous consequences of each.
A political observer described the differences between Adlai Stevenson and Dwight Eisenhower this way. Stevenson was a man of thought. Eisenhower was a man of action. The Republican Party hired an advertising agency to design a campaign to sell Eisenhower and Nixon to the American public.
The man from Abilene. Out of the heartland of America, out of this small frame house in Abilene, Kansas, came a man, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Through the crucial hour of historic D-Day, he brought us to the triumphant peace of VE Day. Now another crucial hour in our history. The big question.
General, if war comes, is this country really ready?
It is not. We haven't enough tanks for the fighting in Korea. It is time for a change.
The nation, haunted by the stalemate in Korea, looks to Eisenhower. Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
Adlai Stevenson was known as an intellectual, an egghead. He dismissed some traditional political advisors and replaced them with fellow eggheads when he launched his campaign. The biggest issue in the 1952 campaign was communism. Stevenson said America needed to guard against it. Yet, he repeatedly criticized the actions of Senator Joseph McCarthy. For years, the senator from Wisconsin had been denouncing government officials and others as communists. Eisenhower did not criticize McCarthy. Even when the senator accused Eisenhower's good friend and fellow World War II hero, General George Marshall, of being a traitor. The Republican campaign went smoothly until Nixon faced a campaign finance dispute. The vice presidential candidate was under pressure to withdraw. That led to Nixon's famous Checkers speech. He made the speech on national television on September 23, 1952. In it, he denied any wrongdoing. He defended his actions regarding the disputed funds and his decision to keep a special gift from a political supporter.
One other thing I probably should tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat in the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep it.
The speech was a major success. Many Republicans voiced support for Nixon to stay on as Eisenhower's running mate. And Eisenhower agreed. A few weeks before the election, Eisenhower made a powerful speech. He talked about ending the war in Korea.
Now, where will a new administration begin? It will begin with its president taking a firm, simple resolution. That resolution will be to forego the diversions of politics and to concentrate on the job of ending the Korean War until that job is honorably done. That job requires a personal trip to Korea. Only in that way could I learn how best to serve the American people in the cause of peace. I shall go to Korea.
Adlai Stevenson also gave a powerful speech before the election. In it, he told of seeing an America where no man fears to think as he pleases or say what he thinks. An America where no man is another's master, where no man's mind is dark with fear. Adlai Stevenson spoke of a nation at peace with the world, an America as the horizon of human hopes. Americans voted in November. Eisenhower won almost 34 million votes. That was more than any other presidential candidate had ever received. Stevenson won about 27 million votes. Dwight Eisenhower was sworn in as America's 34th president in January of 1953. He was 62 years old. Many problems awaited the new Republican president. Republicans had only a small majority in Congress. Many of them were very conservative and unlikely to support many of Eisenhower's programs. The cost of living in America was rising. Senator Joseph McCarthy was still hunting communists, and the war was still being fought in Korea. But Ike had a lot of experience serving his country. Dwight Eisenhower came from a large family in Abilene, Kansas. They did not have much money. He received a free university education when he was appointed to attend the United States Military Academy at West Point in New York State. He remained in military service for many years. He was a top Army officer by the time the United States entered World War II in 1941. In June of 1944, he led the Allied D-Day invasion of Europe. In 1950, President Truman named him Supreme Commander of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. When Dwight Eisenhower ran for president, supporters shouted, "I like Ike." People liked him because he always seemed calm under pressure. As president, one of the first pressures he would have to deal with was the continuing war in Korea.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.